Welcome, everybody, to Season 11, Episode 6, Quitting Alcohol and Managing Sugar Cravings with Laura McGowan. One of the most combinations I think we have out in our world that we normalize is alcohol and the sugar that accompanies it. And to talk about both today, we have Laura McGowan, who wrote the soul-stirring book, We Are the Luckiest, about her path to getting sober. I pre-ordered the book when it came out in January. I read it within the week I got it, and I had a newborn, like 8-week-year-old, mind you, but it was like my little treat to myself every night. And I was so sad to have it end. So I'm so happy to have her here today to share her wisdom. Laura has had a long, successful career in public relations and the Mad Men-esque drinking culture of advertising. After getting sober, she quickly became recognized as a fresh voice in recovery, beloved for her soulful and irreverent writing online and in print. She now leads sold-out retreats and courses, teaching people how to say yes to a bigger life. I love that. It's not just like anti-addiction, yes to a bigger life. Mm-hmm. She lives outside Boston, Massachusetts with her daughter. Laura writes an award-winning blog, hosted the iTunes Top 100 Home Podcast and Spiritualish, and she's been featured in the New York Times, The Guardian, WebMD, Psychology Today, The Today Show, and more. Laura has an MBA from Babson College and spent 15 years in advertising, managing million-dollar accounts for Fortune 100 companies before transitioning to writing and teaching. Mm-hmm. She's a registered yoga teacher and is currently earning her master's in psychology with an emphasis in addiction studies from Purdue University. She's the founder of several online programs for sobriety and personal development, the Luckiest Club, a sobriety support community, and she teaches workshops and retreats all over the U.S. And her first book, which I mentioned at the top of this, We Are the Luckiest, The Surprising Magic of a Sober Life, released just this January. It was an instant bestseller. Thank you so much for being here, Laura.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I was trying to organize this interview, and all I wanted to do was read passages from the book.
That's fine.
Well, I'm going to read some of them, but then I'm going to also ask you questions.
Yeah, okay.
But the writing is just so soulful, and it pierces at so much truth, which is really my favorite writing. So in We Are the Luckiest, and this is about recovery of alcohol and becoming sober, but as I was reading it, I couldn't help think this is a very similar process to healing our relationship to food. Mm-hmm. Because as you said in your talk at The Strand, it's about straightening out our stories and digesting our stories about ourselves. And in my language, I think you talk about facing ourselves, our emotions, and learning to embrace our creative power, which in your case was creative writing. Mm-hmm. So one of the things you talked about in the book and on social media is how we normalize drinking when there's nothing normal about our relationship to alcohol as a collective.
Yep.
And a big part of my work with clients is helping them see the stories they've been socialized into and what they think are their choices because of this socialization versus what really works for them and what they want to choose.
Yeah.
So can you describe your process of recognizing our collective story around alcohol is quite unhealthy, even though that's not what we've been socialized to think?
Yeah. So when I was first faced with the fact that I had to get sober, which was in 2013, I actually remember this distinct moment where, for context, I was working I had a very high profile job at this PR marketing agency in Boston. I was traveling all over the world for work. I was leading a team, managing these big accounts. I lived in a pretty affluent place. I had lots of friends and family that wanted me around, and everyone around me drank too, you know, whether it's work or home or, well, I was separated at the time, but friends, all that. Alcohol was very ubiquitous with my circles, and I think that's pretty much the case for most people. So I remember this moment, like I had hit a point where it was like, I had to face the fact that this was not going to work in my life anymore if I wanted to keep my daughter and probably and keep my job. And I remember riding on a train to work. So I lived outside this. I live outside the city. I was riding on the train, and I had been trying to get sober, you know, trying to go to meetings, trying to piece together days, just really profoundly struggling for a couple months at that point. And I was I had drank the night before and I was hungover again. And I was so defeated and so deflated and so angry that, like, I didn't know where the anger was coming from. But I remember coming up out of the train station, you know, so I remember being like a very steamy day in the city, and I remember coming up and just, I was thinking of all my friends. I was thinking of like everyone I know. And I just had this like moment where it hit me like, this is, we're all deluded. Like this is so much bigger than Laura has a problem, or Laura is an alcoholic, as I had been told. Laura is unique. You know, this is so much bigger than that. We've all bought into this insanity around drinking. And I happened to cross some sort of elusive imaginary line at some point that put me in the problem category. But man, there were so many, like everyone I knew, the alcohol was not doing them any favors, right? Mm-hmm. And there was so much that occurred to me in that moment. And I didn't even have the words for it then, or like, I didn't have my argument solid. I didn't understand fully what I meant, but I just knew like, this is so much bigger. We don't even understand the water we're swimming in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just started this like process of like really not just dealing with my own issues. For example, it was crazy to me that the only place I could go to talk about alcohol and my problem with alcohol was in an anonymous meeting, you know? Or I could read about it in a book. Like no one was talking about it. It was like this, the last thing we really wanted to talk about. Even with my girlfriends, where we would talk about anything, you know, literally anything. No one would talk about alcohol. So that was something to me. It was like, why do we protect this so much? Why am I suddenly now supposed to go deal with this problem alone? And shut up about it, right? If I had cancer, or if I had depression, or if I had whatever, that wouldn't be the case. I mean, sure, there'd probably be friends that are more or less willing to talk to me about it because of their comfort with, but this was like a just hard no. Like no one knew what to talk about. No one wanted to go there. So that was a tip off for me. It's like, we've got some weird shit going on around here. And then I started doing, you know, just research and just sort of like, because that's what I do. Like, I just want to absorb information and figure this out and learn more. And it's like, I learned that alcohol is the most dangerous drug that there is. It's the cause of more deaths than all the other drugs combined, except for cigarettes. If it was created as a new drug today, it would be banned. There's no way it would be legal to sell alcohol. Like I learned all these things and it's like, and yet we like love it and we prize it and we put it in these beautiful bottles. And we, in my mom's circles, you know, it was like, we basically promoted like over drinking. And in my friend circles and in my work, the go hard or go home attitude, and you work hard and you play hard. I mean, everyone was drinking a lot. Not only did we not think much of it, it was like a badge of honor. And yet here I was, and this thing literally almost killed me many times over. So I just started to put these pieces together, you know, it's like, wait, okay, yes, I have a problem that I have to deal with. And I'm not saying that everybody has the same relationship with alcohol that I do or did, but also the culture around alcohol is insane. And we have to look like, ask the questions that aren't even being asked. Like there's so many assumptions that we don't even think about and we don't realize how blind we are to it, right?
Yeah. And I love that you mentioned you didn't even have the language for it, but there was this intuitive we have to look at the collective, because I think one of the things around health and wellness that is so dangerous that mixes with this American narrative of individualism, right?
Like,
you are responsible for your health, you're responsible for your financials, like all of this stuff, we basically think we have to go at it alone. And so we never think to look at the collective. To your point, we don't know the questions to ask. That's not something that like, well, let's look at how I'm socialized or like how I'm being influenced, because we're like, no, we are the rugged individual that is rebellious and free. And I know as someone who likes to think of himself as a rebel, it's always humbling when I'm like, oh no, that was not really your idea. You've been brainwashed, or not brainwashed, but you know, socialized.
Culturalized
into it. But I love that you followed that intuitive sense even without the language. And then isn't it amazing? Once you start to get that like intuitive questioning, then you find all the data that you're like, and did you feel, because this is how I felt about as I started to learn about food for being a source of medicine instead of just calories or whatever. And again, this was 20 years ago when I figured this out.
But
did you find it kind of isolating? Because the more you learn, the more society looks insane. And you're like, wait, why do we think it's normal to like treat animals like this in industrial agriculture or whatever it is? And so it can be kind of isolating, because what you're doing, to your point, like it was kind of a badge of honor in all your circles, you know?
Oh, yeah, it was hugely isolating. I mean, I luckily had a friend that I made really quickly who I have no doubt we were brought together to, so that we could go through this path, you know, but that felt the same way I did about all of it. And we would talk and confirm each other's suspicions and like test our ideas and things like that. Yeah, because it is isolating, because even in, you know, AA circles, which I love, I was, you know, AA saved my life. It's also a very different way of thinking. You know, in AA, there are alcoholics and then there are normies, people who can drink quote unquote normally. And while I do believe in the concept of alcoholism, for sure, the idea that alcohol is okay for everybody else, that it that it doesn't have this deleterious effect on anyone who drinks it, is such a fallacy. You know, unless you're an alcoholic, then you're fine. It's such a lie. And later, you know, that was 2013, and I started writing. You know, you figure these things out as you go. Like you figure out the language, because there's so many different pieces to this. I also like want to comment on the individualism in that, yes, I agree with what you were saying. And I also deeply believe in personal responsibility, deeply.
Yeah.
But you have to look at the reality of cultural norms and the way that you're influenced and just sort of these foregone conclusions, these things that have made their way into your subconscious that operate the way that you, that form the way you operate, right? That stuff is real too. You have to look at that too. So it's tricky. It's layered. It's not a straightforward argument. It's testing paradox. And so it's taken a long time. Still figuring out certain ideas. But then, you know, 2017, this Lancet study came out and said there is no safe amount of alcohol. That the amount of alcohol that is safe is zero. I was like, thank you.
Yeah.
Fucking thank you. You know?
That's the challenge of rewriting our stories, is like, what are we measuring, right? Like in the story of, well, alcohol can be safe. It's like, well, what does that mean? Like you're not driving drunk. Like that's often we think in these black and white extremes versus I cited a study in Well-Rounded about how like alcohol raises your blood sugar and it makes you lose capacity for emotional resilience.
Yeah.
So what are we really measuring when we say this is safe? Or this is normal. And that's what you really have to unpack, I think, in terms of the narrative around anything. It's like, well, how are we
this? Yeah, absolutely. And then there's the reasons why studies like that don't get published. It's like, it's big industry. And there's all kinds of factors. I mean, what we're measuring. So one of the ways that I have been able to get through to people, especially women, is to talk about anxiety and alcohol, because there is a correlation. A very strong correlation between, you know, anxiety disorder. What the hell is it?
So anxiety is often what it's called.
But it's the most common diagnosis, and especially for women. And women are this sort of emerging market of drinkers. We're drinking more than we ever have. So yes, there are many factors that play into anxiety, but the research also shows that there is a direct correlation to anxiety and experience heightened anxiety after drinking. It's a depressant. So there's that too. And I never put it together, which is so funny because the anxiety in the end was what actually just murdered me. You know, my last day of drinking, the thing that I said to myself was not, it wasn't the, you know, I can't ever experience making those mistakes again. I can't ever experience saying things I don't want to say again. I can't ever experience driving drunk again. None of, all of that. Yes. No, I didn't want to experience it that again, but it was anxiety that I said, I can't ever feel this way again. Not even one more day in my life. It was so horrific. I just wanted to die. You feel like you're dying. And yet I had been experiencing that for years, like 15 years, you know, and I didn't put it together because what we're told is that it helps. It's relaxing, you know, have a drink, take the edge off. But the reality is you have that relief when you get that hit of dopamine for about 20 minutes. And then there's a rebound that you pay for hours, sometimes days.
Yeah. Well, and I love that you say that because I think so many people struggle with anxiety and they don't know it because it's been normalized, right? It's part of the matrix of getting out of these stories. To your point, you're like, I've been experiencing this for 15 years, which is part of why it's hard to recognize it.
Exactly. Right. It's just a state. And look, it's so easy to just get medication. Medicate that. You know, I knew exactly how to, I was like this mad scientist, you know, I knew how to try to regulate my state with caffeine, alcohol, Xanax, Ambien. I knew exactly how to do it so that I could maintain this sort of shitty level of existing, I guess. But I didn't know how bad it was. Like you said, the matrix is a great way to put it. You don't know how bad it is until you step out of it.
Yeah. I love that you said, because I think owning our story, I mean, again, we talk about owning our stories a lot here, and I think it's becoming a lot more in the mainstream. And I love that you said that you were making it up as you go, because in your book you wrote, I just love this passage. You said, I wasn't any of the stories I had been telling myself. Mm-hmm. I was just a girl lying on a rug, feeling something by herself, but not alone. I had witnessed her. She had been witnessed. This might have been the first time I experienced true intimacy. Mm. And that, like, because I think intimacy is what we're all, especially emotional intimacy, craving so much, right? Part of why we need each other and connection. And so how did you learn to discern? And you also said, I love this line, put yourself in a house where the truth is told. Mm. And so how did you learn to discern what was the truth for you? Not what was the worst of your struggles or thoughts you had about yourself?
That's such a good question because it's really hard.
Right? Yeah.
Well, for a long time, I had to lean on other women who could see me and had been through what I had been through and come out the other side and could reflect back to me who I was before I believed it.
You know, that just gave me chills.
Yeah, I couldn't do it myself. That's part of this whole collective thing. I couldn't do it myself. I believe so strongly, and I am the most anti-joiner. I would rather die than admit that I need help. I'm much better now. But I couldn't do it by myself. So I've always been a seeker. I've relied on spiritual texts to help me a lot. I relied on other women primarily, honestly, to do what I said, to really reflect back to me what was true until I internalized it. And that those were people in AA, those were therapists, those were friends who wanted to see me grow, people like my brother. So that's how it started. And then what happens, the other piece of that is I started talking. There's a reason we tell stories. And when you say owning your story, that means many things. But one of the things it means to me that I always encourage people to do, and I think you have to do, is speak your story over and over and over and over and over again until you start to rewrite it and straighten it out. Not rewrite it in like some fictionalized sense, but you start to understand it. Speaking is alchemical. It's transformative. There's a reason that we share things through the ages by story, because that's the primary mechanism of which we understand life from a psychological perspective. So you do have this capacity to understand your story. So the way I always envisioned it was like, if you remember like old cassette tapes, and the ribbon would come out and it would get all jangled up.
Yeah. Oh, I hated that. You tried
and like with the yeah, pen. Right. And like twisted and sometimes in knots, and you'd have to go really, really slow, twisting and twisting and twisting just to like bring it back into the cassette and straighten it out. But it can be done. And I think that is what happens in the process of recovery for me, recovery for anybody, from whatever you're recovering from, you know, wherever you're headed to, is like, you have to really understand your story, because so much of what we believe ourselves is based on limiting beliefs that we absorbed as a childhood that live in our subconscious. We don't even know that we have them, right? Mm-hmm.
Preach.
Like 95% of what we're operating on, of how we behave, is run by our subconscious. 95%. So there's a lot of junk in there. And we have to start to pull apart what's true. And I guess, you know, you said, like, how do you know what's true versus a lie? I mean, the way that I think about it is, I write about this in the book, actually, like, truth can be uncomfortable, but it feels expansive.
Yeah, I love when you talked about that.
But like, does something not true or something dishonest or a lie is also uncomfortable, but it feels restrictive. There's nowhere to go with it. Whereas the truth it's confining. Lies are confining. Untruths are confining. There's nowhere to go. And then whereas truth is expansive, it's still uncomfortable, but it's expansive. Yeah. And then there's many other things I could bring up too. You know, like I saw, because I did see my own darkness, I did see my own shadow, I did see all these horrible things that I was capable of. And yet, I was still here. I knew that I had a goodness in me too. I knew that I had a loving heart. I knew that I loved my daughter. And so you start to understand that we all have all of that inside of us. We all have the capacity. So it's not I'm either all good or all bad, or 75% good and 25% bad. It's like, no, we have everything in us. We all have everything in us. So that's just a fact, right? Accepting that and having a lived experience of that, it has the potential to breed a lot more compassion for yourself. Through that, I could start to see myself as someone who was just in a lot of pain and therefore did the things that she needed to do to get her needs met because she was in a lot of pain and she didn't know any better, versus someone that was just like this debased piece of crap.
Yeah. That was a question that I had for you, is like, is that what you've come to believe, is like alcohol is a symptom, not
totally
the problem, right?
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah.
It's a solution. I mean, I know you talk about sugar that way.
Yeah. It's a solution, not the problem. Yeah.
It's like alcohol was my friend, man. I needed it. It got me through a lot.
I love that you just mentioned about developing compassion for ourselves, right? So that we can hold the quote good and bad. Although the more you do it, I love that you said paradox is what you kind of have to hold, because you start to realize good and bad are constructs as well, right?
Yeah.
But in one episode this season, I talked about this sacrifice reward story that I think causes us to eat, but I also see it causing people to drink, whether they consider themselves alcoholics or just at night they need it to unwind.
Mm-hmm.
And in the group, you talk about being in a running group and you say, I was always proud of myself for the willingness to pick myself up off the side of the street and get the training run done. Mm-hmm. It tracked with my resolve to be, quote, strong, like I had learned to do as a kid. Mm-hmm. Now looking back, I wonder if this act of, quote, discipline was mostly just an act of self-aggression. I wonder what I needed more than to pick myself up and keep running was to admit that I needed to stop. I wonder if what I needed was to ask for help. I wonder if this is what so many of us need when we think we need to get our shit together, to let it fall apart instead. And I have chills just reading it again. So can you talk about, again, a little bit of your process of learning to stay and why this is crucial for really, you know, owning our story, but being with our good and bad, quote, good and
bad. Yeah, yeah. For me, it all comes back to learning to stay. I'm a huge sort of follower, lover, believer in Buddhist practices and Buddhism itself. I've learned so much from my Buddhist teachers. The natural tendency when we experience discomfort as human beings is to want to get out of it, right? Emotional discomfort, physical discomfort, psychological discomfort. It's our natural instinct to want to get out of it. And unfortunately, we have developed a million ways to do that. You really don't have to be with yourself at all in the way that we live, you know?
Right. Especially with social media. I mean, it's like...
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me started. Right.
Yeah.
We had a whole conversation about that before we even started. But
yeah.
But you really don't have to be with yourself, you know? What Buddhism teaches is that it's essentially to learn how to be okay with what is, with the present moment, with what is. And that's the thing that we all fight. And those that struggle with addiction, I mean, that is the root of addiction. It says, I'm in too much pain. And sometimes you are, you know, the original. So the way I talk about this is like the sort of defense mechanisms we develop as children are very intelligent.
Yeah.
For example, like I learned to shapeshift really fast so that I could get my needs met. And by shapeshift, I mean, I'll be whatever I need to be so that I can get my needs by my dad, say. And what that looks like is saying that I'm fine, not showing weakness, not showing sensitivity, never being able to predict anger and avoid it at all costs. Essentially, I learned to lie. Yeah. And that's it's an intelligent mechanism as a child to survive your environment. And there are many of them that we develop as an adult. And what happens when we do that is we leave ourselves.
Mm.
Essentially, I grew up abandoning myself and over and over and over and learning that that's what was required to be okay in the world, to be okay with friend groups, to be okay, just to be okay, to achieve enough like homeostasis internally to survive. And of course, I didn't know any of this. Like we can talk about it now, but I've always been extraordinarily sensitive. I've always been a big feeler. And I learned what I needed to be liked, to be accepted, and to get my needs met. And that's all we're ever looking for. It's all anybody's ever looking for. So you go forward into adulthood and you carry these same patterns, but they're destructive to relationships and to your life, really. As you progress through life, the way I talk about it is having, like, I was many different people. I had many versions of Laura out there in the world. And that is an extraordinarily painful way to live. I think we've all lived that way. I think you kind of have to live that way until you reach the painful spot where it's no longer tolerable. And then that's a process we all go through. So essentially, this is a problem of not being able to stay with yourself. It's thinking that how you feel, say shame comes up, anger comes up. Well, that's just wrong. I can't feel that way. I can't stay with it. It's too uncomfortable. I have to do something to take it away. And then, so we reach for alcohol, we reach for food, we reach for our phone, we reach for whatever it is. And those things work. They do.
Yeah.
Like they work for a while, you know? And in the process, we become addicted. And what happens when we don't stay and say we don't feel our way through a feeling is we don't get the lesson in that feeling.
I love that.
Shame has a lesson. It's all of our emotions are useful. They're not like ghosts that are trying to haunt us or kill us. You know, they're energetic messengers and they all carry a specific message. Anger has a message. Shame has a message. grief, sadness, even jealousy and envy, they are neutral, so to speak, but they were created evolutionarily to keep us safe, keep us alive, keep us with our tribes, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But we've learned to, like, we don't like to feel them. The energy of shame is like, no one likes to feel that. It feels fucking terrible.
Totally. Oh, it's the worst.
Yeah. Anger for a lot of women is demonized, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I love how you say these are essentially neutral. But again, if we think of stories, you can't be an angry woman.
Can't be an angry woman, right? You can't be a sensitive man or whatever all the, you know.
There's so many stories around what we're allowed to feel and not feel.
Right. And so what that means is we do things to manage that because you have to. The other part of emotions and trauma and all that is none of us gets away with anything, you know? Like when we don't digest these experiences, it's like they just go away. They get stuffed. They make us sick. They don't go away. So they have to come out somehow. So the process of learning to stay is really what sobriety is to me. It's learning how to stay with whatever is. And I think it's the hardest thing to do. I mean, there's a reason that Buddhism has been going on for so long. There's a reason why, you know, essentially Buddhists are tasked, the Buddhist monks, that's all they really did, really, is learn how to breathe and stay with what is.
Yeah.
So it is the sort of pith instruction. And what that means for me, what that started to look like was like, okay, can I sit with what's coming up for me right now, whatever it happened to be, and not drink? That was the practice for a long time. Just not drink, right? And then it was, can I sit with whatever's coming up and not engage in other behaviors that I'm escaping to? And it's not like we seek to become like just pure renunciation of everything, but it's like, there's no way we can grow without the, I guess, burning is the word that comes to mind, but the burning through of those emotions. Like they are meant to move through us. They are meant to inform us and inform our lives and how we make decisions. That's how we become integrated, right? That's how we become ourselves.
I love how you use the word burning, because I think if we apply that metaphor to health, like when you have a fever, your body's really trying, like everyone wants to bring the fever down with medication, but it's like, no, the body's actually, like the fever is helping burn through.
it's a necessary process, right?
Yeah. But it's like people take Tylenol or whatever. And again, sometimes it's so high, you need help. So it's all about context, but it's like so uncomfortable and people are so afraid of it, but you got to burn through whatever is there. And I think it comes back to your earlier point of like the payoff is the expansion, right? It is meeting who you really are, not kind of the stories you've told yourself or all that kind of stuff, and having deeper intimacy with your life and who and what your purpose and relationships and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And really with yourself, like most people just don't know who they are. We have referenced who we are based on the outside for so long that they can't even answer simple questions like, am I tired? Mm-hmm. Am I hungry? Am I cold? Am I angry? You know, like that, it's like you really have to get to know yourself. And it's not this like navel-gazy, like there's a whole way that can go wrong in thinking, you know, that you just self-love and get to know yourself. And it can all sound so like BS.
Yeah, light.
Yeah,
like,
but
that's not where the interesting stuff is.
No, but it's like you have a part to play here. You have a part to play here. And if you do not become who you are not playing that part, right? So I look at it more as like this beautiful responsibility.
Yeah. Oh, and that's one thing that I wanted to comment earlier when you said in personal responsibility, because that is so true. And I found that when you can understand the structures at play, it's not to blame the structures per se, but it gives you compassion. And it often totally reframes. You're like, wow, I'm actually doing pretty decent considering the structures that are in my life. You know,
yeah.
I always share the example of like when I was, you know, I mean, I'm obviously still building my business, but like I would see like all these people seemingly like zooming ahead. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing wrong? And then Dartmouth did a study and they were like looking for the entrepreneurial gene. And you know, what they came up with was the gene is actually 80% of people who start businesses have family money. And so they're not actually taking any risks. I mean, they take some risks, but it's not the same risk for those of us who don't have family money. And so I was like, okay, if I had family money, I would sure as hell take it, but I don't. But look how well I'm doing considering
yes.
that I don't have that. And so it was like, oh, rather than beating myself up, I feel like a badass now.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
And that's a concrete example of we can look at alcohol or even food is encouraged in the same way. But looking at the structures of how we normalize trauma and how we don't want to look at pain is like, oh, I'm actually considering how much we numb, I'm actually doing pretty great. Like as clients start to unravel their story around food, I'm like, isn't it amazing that you're not eating all the time?
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Pain you're carrying.
That's so true. It's such a good point. It's such a good point. Yeah. Cause I wasn't coming out and saying, you know, oh my God, this is such a fucked up environment. It's all everyone else's fault. You know, da, da, da. It's just like having a clear view of the reality that we live in. And I say it like, it's not your fault. Like the traumas that happened to you are not your fault. The culture that you live in is not your fault. You know, all of that is not your fault. But then the second part to that is it is your responsibility.
I love how you make that distinction. When I read that once, again, that's like your social media feed. It's like, I just went to church and like...
Oh my God, that's funny.
So one of the things that you do talk about in the book is that how you started to pay attention to your diet after getting sober.
Mm-hmm.
And you also said you had a history of eating disorders. And so mm-hmm. you didn't want too much structure, which I love that you bring that up. Mm-hmm. And noticed your sugar habit was, you said, well, excessive.
Well,
I understand because I actually never really drank because I wanted to eat all my calories.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a noble thing. It was just like, well, this, you know. But anyways, will you describe what happened with that? Because I do get a lot of clients who have given up alcohol and then sugar really increases for them. And that's where they're coming for me. So I would think people would love to hear what that process was and now your current relationship to sugar. Because it shifts and changes. It doesn't necessarily unlit them.
It does. Yeah. Yeah, it does. This is fun. I haven't talked really about this much. So I just noticed when I stopped drinking, I literally found myself like standing in front of the freezer, eating frozen gummy bears and spooning ice cream, like in my really early days of sobriety, like completely unconsciously. And I was like, huh. And it was helping me feel better. Right. It was like this really strong craving. And I was like, huh. Okay, this is interesting. I remember texting my sponsor and being like, what's up with this? She's like, oh yeah, it's a totally normal thing. So it's like, what happens to everybody? It's real. Your body's trying to replace dopamine and whatever. I'm sure you have a much more specific explanation.
No, that's
for that.
Pretty much it. And it's a numbing device, right?
It's a numbing device, right.
Taper off numbing devices and intensity.
Right. So I just kind of went with it. Honestly, I didn't give a shit what I was... As long as I wasn't drinking, I let myself do everything else. And that was what I needed to do because for me, everyone's different. That's just how it had to be for me. And I kind of said, whatever, you know, I'm going to tackle these things in the order they're killing me. But then it got to be, you know, like 3.5-4 years in and I was like still having a lot of ice cream every night. And I would get like bags of candy at 7-Eleven. And it was like, not just eating sugar in my foods, but mainlining sugar to the point where I didn't feel good. Like my energy was terrible and my sleep was not great. And I just knew it was like, you gotta look at this. But I also had a history of really bad eating disorders. And so any kind of restriction for me, any kind of diet, really even just the framework of a diet for me would put me in a pretty bad place, right?
So, and this is an interesting process. What I started to do was it started
with a wheat belly. I read that. I was like,
sure, we'll try that.
Sure, why not?
And then I did that for a little while and I pretty much hated it, but it did bring my sugar down a lot. And then I did like a whole 30 and that helped with the sugar, but it really had me over focusing on food, which I hated. Like, and I know everybody is different. I realized that anything that had me focusing on rules around food was no good for me. As soon as I had rules, I overfocused on it to the point of obsession and being miserable and then worrying about 15 calories, you know? And like, I can't live that way. I already lived that way. And it's hell for me. It's an absolute hell. It was the most miserable I've been, you know, like as a 17, 18 year old, obsessed about my diet and weighing, and it's absurdly low weight and all that. So I started to learn more about that. And this is, I think, the most important point. What I had been doing all along in sobriety was a lot of personal development work, therapy, spiritual work. But I really kicked it into seriously high gear around the time that I realized dieting doesn't work, Laura. And I had this like stuff come around. I call it my like original wound. It was like the stuff around relationships, the romantic relationships. And I went into like this really intense therapy with therapists. I did a lot of different things. I did a lot of like energetic stuff. And at the same time, I said, there are no rules anymore. There's no rules for Laura and how she eats. I just started paying attention to what I felt like when I ate things. And that's about it, right? And for a while, things went haywire. You know, I was like, you eat all the forbidden foods and all, but it honestly lasted for like 2 weeks. I'm like, okay, this isn't even interesting anymore. But I think the more important part was I was working through the emotional stuff. Like I was really working through that and not focusing on the food. And it was hard. I had to give myself permission to not focus on the food and especially about the sugar. And I just noticed that it slowly started to leave.
Yeah, because you were doing the work around relationship,
pain,
yeah,
my issues, whatever you want to call it. I was doing that work, and you know that really brings me up until a couple months ago. And what my relationship looks like with food now is like it's never ever been before. It's no big deal. Like,
I love that.
Oh, this is so interesting. Like when the pandemic hit, and I'm sure you heard this so much. I was like, I got to go on a diet. I got to have a plan, you know, because I started to eat more and then that scared me. And I saw that happen. I was like, nope, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. I watched this cycle happen. It was like, you're going to consume more food, maybe more sugar for a little while. And then it just went back down to regular. Like it just evened out again.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other important point, which is again, the anxiety is what you connected with alcohol, right? Is when you start focusing on how you feel versus these artificial, I'm being good or bad or getting ahead with my weight loss or behind with it. When you focus, I call them on the quick fixes, like immediate intrinsic rewards.
Yeah.
That paired with the emotional work is so powerful because again, you're doing it for yourself. And to be with yourself in a better way versus for the external payoff of weight loss or being able to say, I'm sugar free, you know, because that's then, how do you do that? You know, or like,
yeah,
whatever, you know, whatever it is. But I so appreciate you sharing that you did the work around relationships. And do you think that is part of what also drove the eating disorders as well?
100%. It was the same pain, the same trauma, the same stuff that drove the alcohol. It is exactly the same stuff.
Yeah.
Food came before alcohol, by the way. I was using food to medicate. I remember like so clearly as a child. My eating disorder really blew up at the end of high school. And then what happened when I left high school is I went to college. And what happened then? Started drinking.
Oh, that's where my... eating disorder like exploded in college.
Well, so I had done this thing where I had major restriction up until I went to college. And as you know, that can only go on so long before the body freaks the fuck out.
Yeah.
And I call it like the rubber band snapped and I just binged. It was for the next 10 years, it was binging, purging. So I gained a lot of weight back, but the alcohol supplanted the food thing. It just did. Mm-hmm. It like masked it. By the end of my drinking, I just wasn't eating because I was so sick. And then when I quit drinking, the food thing came back. And I hear this literally every day. It's the story for a lot of people. The food, it's because it all comes from the same place. It all comes from the same place. We're trying to medicate our internal states and not being able to, and that's that concept of staying is what works for all of this too. But with help, I can see the biggest shift in my relationship with food as a result of this, the emotional work. It had nothing to do with like somehow setting up the right food plan. The food plan is literally no food plan. I have no food plan. I don't even talk about food.
Yeah. Well, because it's like, for me, food is just the vehicle to feel good so you can do these other things. Like, why are we trying to be healthy?
Yeah. Right. Right. And like, I don't berate anyone who does plans, because I know that doesn't work for anyone either. But just for me, it had to be literally there are no rules anymore. There will never be rules again.
Yeah.
No, and I had to deal with gaining weight. Like I gained a little weight, you know, and I was like, it's fine. We're going to just roll with this, you know? And that turned out to be just fine too, you know?
Yeah. And you stayed with, like, again, this concept of staying, making it concrete in terms of sugar is like when COVID hit, you were like, you stayed with, it's gone up a little bit, right? But like, it's almost like when you give yourself the permission, then you don't have to rebel against the restriction. So it's like, the world didn't fall apart. Like it will go up sometimes, it'll go down sometimes, you know?
And that's actually what has to happen. The restriction breeding obsession concept was what solidified it for me. It was like, right, restricting is what breeds obsession for me. And so we're not going to do that anymore. We're not counting calories. We're not doing anything except for paying attention to how I feel. And I have friends that this is like, this would never work for them, you know, but this is, for me, it's what means freedom. And that's what I want. I want freedom more than anything.
Yeah. And I love that quote. I mean, we're all different, right? But for a lot of us who had so many rules around food for so long, it's like, it just doesn't work. And like, because I was in my Cheers with Food group this week and it was nice. Clients were like, I'm so appreciative that this is such an integrative process, because they're like, if it was about the food, I would have found the perfect plan. You know,
exactly. Yes.
So I love that you can articulate and have done the emotional work around your relationship, you know, issues. And it's like, oh, the food is just a symptom, just like alcohol and other stuff. I think that's so important for people to hear. And it doesn't mean things go away magically. It's like coming back to that staying of like, okay, I'm in a pandemic. You know, eating a little bit more here. But do you find, at least, I don't know, I think my clients find this and I found this, it's like you weren't with the pandemic because you were also doing the emotional work and gave yourself permission. It wasn't like you were going out and buying the bags of frozen gummy bears anymore. Like, I do think it gets a little bit better each time that you practice.
It does. But if I do, I don't, it's like no big deal.
Oh, yeah.
But no, over time, it's just, it doesn't occur to me, you know, or things will sit in my house and go bad.
Yeah.
That would never have sat in my house and go bad. I'd be obsessed about them till they were gone, you know?
Yeah.
It's a lot like quitting drinking, where you just realize the amount of energy and time and effort it took just to try to manage something that could be spent in a million different ways. Other ways.
Well, and that's another thing I work on with my clients on the emotional side. When we were talking about what are you measuring, it's also measuring over the longer term instead of like in that moment, right? Because
totally,
it can create a self-fulfilling prophecy for many people, when you put the restriction on, it's like, okay, the next day, it's like, no, let's look at this over months and bigger patterns than, you know, just just what you did last night. But that takes a lot more staying in trust, I think, of ourselves, which can be challenging.
Yeah, it's a process. Like, we're in a process. We have to look at it that way. And sobriety is a process of any kind. And I'll be sober 6 years this year. You know, I always tell people, like, take whatever timeline you have for your self-improvement and extend it out like 10 years.
Yeah, I was like, that is radical honesty.
that is the real reality, you know?
Yeah. And I love when you say at the end of the book, it says, believe me when I tell you, you will not be left out of the miracle if you keep going. Mm-hmm. And I think I was like, that's so true. Like, I always just want people to keep going because it does get
Yes.
I would love you to describe when you keep going. So many of my clients find that creativity, and it doesn't have to be just like art, typical art, right? Or whatever people think of as typically creative, but how important creativity is in part of that miracle you're describing.
Yeah.
Unused creativity is not benign. I'm all like,
Yeah, it's not, because it's potential. It's your unused potential, right?
Love that.
And it goes back to this Gospel of Thomas quote that I love that says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. And if you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. And I think that for me, that was absolutely true. Like, the alcohol was killing me for sure, but the not using my potential was absolutely crushing my spirit. I knew it, I felt it. It was devastating. I was supposed to be a writer. I was supposed to be writing. I was supposed to be doing what I'm doing now. I know that, you know, and I wasn't doing it. And it was like, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about you have a dharma. You in yogic texts talked about as dharma, which is a truth. It's a path. It's a unique blueprint that each of us has. When we don't fulfill that, it's a soul death. You know, it's like a spiritual death. And creativity looks different for everybody. Life is a creative act.
Yes.
So you're creating your reality every day, whether you're a lawyer or a writer or whatever. And it's not about your job so much either. It can be part of it, but it's not just about that. It's about,
I brought up that point.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to monetize everything anymore.
No, God. Oh, yeah. It's like, you want me to share the best story? You'll freaking love this story. So this is it. Someone brought this up in a meeting that I was hosting recently, and I will never forget it. It is a story called Why Were You Not? Because there's a tale of the Hasidic rabbi named Rabbi Zoyza. Zoyza was a timid man who lived a humble life. One day, Rabbi Zoyza stood before his congregation and he said, "When I die and have to present myself before the celestial tribunal, they will not ask me, Zoyza, why were you not Moses? Because I would say Moses was a prophet and I am not. And they will not say, Zoyza, why were you not Jeremiah? For I would say Jeremiah is a writer and I am not. And they will not say, why were you not Rabbi Akiba? For I would tell them Rabbi Akiba was a great teacher and a scholar and I am not. But then they will say, Zoyza, why were you not Zoyza? And to this, I will have no answer."
I love that. Because I think that sums up what you've been saying, is like, when you learn to stay with yourself, you realize like you don't want someone else's life. Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot to wean through, but you start to be with also that creative potential, which sometimes there's some darkness, right? Like, our pain can transform, but it also is like what they would call the golden shadow, right? The parts that we're not owning that are powerful as well.
Yeah, and if you aren't, it's like, that is the only thing, is to become who you are. That's the only thing. That is the only job any of us has, right? Because that's what gives our life meaning. And meaning is actually what we want. It's not happiness or pleasure or like all of that. Those things can be byproducts of meaning, but if we don't have meaning, we're done. So,
yeah. And there's actually a lot of medical research, and well, not a lot, but a few studies on how meaning, like, people who describe themselves as having meaningful lives actually live longer than people who consider themselves to have like happy lives in terms of hedonistic pleasure.
Absolutely.
I think it's like the most underscored health metric.
Yes. Well, it's like if you've read Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, you know, that's basically the premise of his entire book, you know, and he was in concentration camps and he survived a wife, brothers and sisters, and I think maybe even parents. And that's what he found there, that if you can create those who were able to psychologically survive or those who had could find meaning even in that, in those circumstances. So it's a real thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Laura. You have created so much meaning out of your challenges that all of us are benefiting from. And is there anything you'd like to add that I didn't ask before we wrap up?
No, thank you. It was so nice to talk to you again.
Yeah. And all of your, I mean, the links to your website and everything will be in the show notes. Where else you'd like people to be able to find you? I know you're taking a little social media hiatus, so.
Yeah. I mean, I'm on Instagram as Laura_McCowan, and then everything I have is on my website right now. So, and that's just my name also.
Yeah. Which is LauraMCKOWEN.com. And again, we'll have all of this on the show notes as well as a transcript. So
awesome.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. This was, again, I feel like I went to church.
Yeah.
My version of church. Devotion, I should say. Maybe it was Kupalu or something.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Love you. Bye.
Yeah, love you. Thank you, Health Rebels, for tuning in today. Have a reaction, question, or want the transcript from today's episode? Find me at alishapiro.com. I'd love if you leave a review on Apple Podcast and tell your friends and family about Insatiable. It helps us grow our community and share a new way of approaching health and our bodies. Thanks for engaging in a different kind of conversation. And remember, always, your body truths are unique, profound, real, and liberating.